Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming. This is, as you can see, a session on the Long 60s, the counterculture's influence in contemporary America. I'm Peter Richardson. I'm going to moderate. Let me just remind you of the usual things of turning off your cell phones, and also be sure to know that I will hold plenty of time at the end of the session today for your questions. We have an hour and 15 minutes, a lot of ground to cover, and I'm very eager to get started. I also want to thank Reed Schmidt for sponsoring this session. Thank you, Reed. Our topic today is the Long 60s. We want to use that as a kind of shorthand for the ways that movements and events and historical figures from that decade have shaped and in many ways continue to shape American culture more broadly. And we're going to focus on the Bay Area counterculture in particular, which is celebrating an anniversary this year, as you probably know, with a lot of high-profile events and exhibits on the Summer of Love. There was the Hippie Modernism show here in Berkeley, as well as many other events. I want to slip in a quick plug, if I can, for the California Historical Society, which is sponsoring their own events and also serving as a kind of clearinghouse for information about related events. So a quick visit to their website, California Historical Society, might pay off for you if you're interested in those events. I'm Peter Richardson. I teach humanities and American studies at San Francisco State University, and I've also written books about Ramparts Magazine and the Grateful Dead, which may or may not come up in the course of the conversation. Thank you. So we have four experts today, and I'd like to introduce them briefly before launching into our discussion. Fred Turner is the Harry and Norman Chandler Professor and Chair of the Department of Communication at Stanford University. He's the author of three books. The one that we're especially interested in today is called From Counterculture to Cyberculture, Stuart Brand, The Whole Earth Network, and the Rise of Digital Utopianism. Before coming to Stanford, Fred taught at Harvard and MIT and also worked for 10 years as a journalist. Gretchen Lemke Santangelo is a professor of history at St. Mary's College in Moraga. She's the author or co-author of three books, including Daughters of Aquarius, Women of the 60s Counterculture, one review called that book, An In-Depth View of the Experiences of Young Women Who Rejected Mainstream Society in the 60s, and also an excellent overview of the hippie phenomenon writ large. Yeah. Matt Callahan is a musician, author, and historian, originally from San Francisco, now living in Switzerland. Like Fred and Gretchen, he's also the author of three books, including The Explosion of Deferred Dreams, Musical Renaissance and Social Revolution in San Francisco, 1965 to 1975. That book explores the music and politics of that eventful decade when San Francisco was both a global rock capital and an epicenter of radical politics. And finally, we have David Talbot, now a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. David, of course, founded both Salon.com and Hot Books, which publishes works on political and politics and current affairs. His own books include Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love, which I think spent 4 years on the Northern California bestseller list, and also The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. Please join me in welcoming our panelists today. Fred, let me start with you. You've written about the connection between the Bay Area counterculture in the early years of the Silicon Valley. It's an incredibly rich and important topic. And my first question is simply, how did you get onto it?
I got onto it because I had written a book about how Americans remember the Vietnam War when I was a journalist. I was turning academic, and I moved to California for graduate school. And when I got to California, I found a copy of Wired magazine from 1997. And its cover was sort of pseudo-psychedelic, and it had an article by Stuart Brand in it. And when I had been doing my Vietnam work, I had thought that computers were the enemy of everything associated with the counterculture. I thought that computers were the tools of the Cold War military state. So I began to wonder, how was it that people who I had associated with the counterculture could have become boosters of machines that I thought were everything they stood against? So I started thumbing back through Wired magazine, and it became clear to me that there was a network of folks who had been working loosely together for about 30 years, going all the way back to the Whole Earth Catalog, and Stuart Brand was very much the center of that network, and I began to chronicle the network.
So one of the themes is what you call digital utopianism.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that term, what it means, and where it came from, what the vision behind it is, and how that vision sort of manifested itself.
So digital utopianism, at least as expressed by folks associated with Wired and other folks who were there when the internet went live in the early 90s, had in it, I think, the notion that we could leave our bodies behind and enter a kind of shared space of mind. And once we were in that space of mind, experience a kind of new, intimate society, one that no longer needed politics, no longer needed bureaucracy, but could be sort of newly intimate. Now, I'm looking around the room and I'm thinking some of you might be old enough to remember that that was also the ideology of the commune movement. You know, between 1966 and 1973, we have the largest wave of commune building in all of American history. And folks who headed back to the land very often wanted to have communities of consciousness, communities of shared mind, communities in which they could leave bureaucracy and the state and mainstream America behind. I argue that those dreams from the commune movement, which the Whole Earth Catalog was founded to serve, became the foundation of how we imagined that digital media might provide us a newly disembodied home for communities of consciousness.
You open chapter one with Mario Savio's speech from December 1964, not very far from here, about the necessity of throwing one's body on the gears of the machine. And then you juxtapose that moment with John Perry Barlow's 1996 Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace. Barlow's piece describes national governments as weary giants of flesh and steel and warns them to keep their hands off the internet. How are those two moments linked for you? Are those the bookends for the story that you're telling, or is there some other way that they
go together? I hadn't thought about it quite that way. I think there's a third piece I would add into the way that you've just framed it, which was when the free speech movement started here at Berkeley, it started, one of its flashpoints was the computerization of student records. Mm-hmm. Now, you would think, right, the computerization of student records, we're going to march in the street about that? But people did, and they carried Hollerith cards, the computer punch cards, stamped FSM, a free speech movement. This is, by the way, the origin of the phrase, I am a human being, do not fold, spindle, or mutilate. There was a terrible fear among Berkeley undergraduates in this period that somehow, by having their lives computerized, put into digital bits, they would be disembodied and dehumanized. They would be rendered parts, literally, of the machine. They would be, and that fear, I think, is very powerful. What Mario Savio was doing was reasserting the power of his body, saying, my body matters, I'm going to put my body on the line. But the dream that persisted, and this is the thing that fascinated me, the dream that persisted into the 90s was the dream, in fact, of a disembodied systemic unity. It was a scary thing here at Berkeley in 1964, but it began to animate, I think, a lot of what was happening in San Francisco, particularly in the acid scene by 67, 68, and it traveled very directly into how we imagine network computing later.
Mm-hmm. Now, Barlow, of course, you know, many of you might know that he was a lyricist for the Grateful Dead, and he also co-founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation. It's been a long time since that Declaration of Independence was set out. I think it was in Wired, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
How well do you think that declaration has held up over time?
You know, it's so interesting. I teach the Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace every year to about 100 Stanford undergraduates. And in the beginning, they just loved it. They're like, yeah, that's what we're doing. That's what we're here for. That's why we're building new things. Since Edward Snowden and his revelations and the NSA, they've taken a much darker view. And I think what we're starting to see is something that I find deeply troubling, but also fascinating, which is that the loop is coming full circle. That thing we saw in 1964, the fear that we would be captured in digital systems and rendered vulnerable to large state and corporate systems, has in fact come to be the case. The deep irony is that we got there precisely through the politics and practice of liberation in the 1960s. And to some extent, those of us who were wanting to rebel in 68, 69, help set the stage for a world that we would not otherwise want to live in.
You know, Stuart Brand provides, you mentioned Stuart Brand, and he provides a kind of through line for your story. Tell us a little bit more about Stuart and his significance. I mean, a really pretty incredible life, starting with the Merry Pranksters and Kankakee, and bring it forward from there for us.
Well, so Stuart Brand is a fascinating man. He's had a fascinating life. You know, it's interesting. I think the most important place to start with Stuart is the fact that his father was an ad man. He grew up in Illinois and moved out here, went to Stanford, and he found himself in the Army first, then in a series of art movements, performance art groups, eventually found his way out west as that commune movement was starting to happen. And he wanted to help people find their way back to the land. So he and his wife Lois took some money that he had inherited from his father and used it to create a catalog. Now think about that for a second. A catalog is a mode of political intervention. That's really interesting, and I think that's both I think that's the ad man in him. He believed that what we needed to do was help folks on the communes find tools that would be tools through which they could transform their consciousness, and having transformed their consciousness, build new egalitarian societies. So Stuart is in many ways, I think, what sociologists call a network entrepreneur. He's someone who moves between different social worlds, gathers those social worlds together, listens to what they say, and helps tell a sort of synthetic story that no one network tells on its own, but that he can tell because he's in the middle of the networks. And he's done that across time. He did that first with the Whole Earth Catalog, later with Coevolution Quarterly, later with the Whole Earth Electronic Link, one of the earliest and most important sites of virtual community. And ultimately,
otherwise also called The Well.
Also called The Well, right, yep, also called The Well. And ultimately, he had an awful lot to do with Wired Magazine and its founding, Global Business Network, and now the Long Now Foundation. He's been just incredibly active over time.
So I've got a little quote here. You note that the communards of the 1960s developed a utopian vision that was quite congenial to the insurgent Republicans of the 1990s.
Yeah.
So you touched on this earlier, but how did digital utopianism overlap with the vision that Newt Gingrich and others had for the country at that time?
So I want to say first that I was really pained to come to that conclusion. I turned to studying the counterculture because I had done this book on Vietnam. I had spent 3 years with traumatized combat vets who had fought in the war, and I wanted to find a story from that period that would be more uplifting and more congenial. So imagine my pain when I go to Wired Magazine, and there's Newt Gingrich. He appears in the magazine 3 times. And he was very much anti-free love, anti-drugs, but he was also very much in favor of small-scale technologies and business as the proper ways to make social change. So the logic that drives the Whole Earth Catalog, a catalog of tools organized for searchability, is a logic that's very in sync with the marketing world, with business as a site of social change, as distinct from the state. Remember that in the 60s, the state is the problem. So why would we support the state? Rather, we need to find another way to do things. Stuart Brand and the folks around the Whole Earth Catalog found tools, technologies, consciousness. Newt Gingrich was totally down with that.
Interesting. I want to come back to some of these points, but I also want to turn to Gretchen. Gretchen, your book shows that with very few exceptions, hippie women have been relegated to the margins of when it comes to historical accounts of this period. And that's part of a larger pattern. But are there specific factors at work in the story that you tell that crowded these women out of our histories of that period?
I think the largest factor was that the countercultural press was male-dominated, and the mainstream press was as well. So the kind of reportage that people were receiving about women participants in the counterculture was distorted through that lens. They weren't essentially writing their own stories. That explains it. And the stereotypes that took root, that emerged at the time as well.
So some of your story is organized around some of those stereotypes. Can you mention a few that come to mind?
Sure, and these will probably seem familiar to many of you. The air-brained hippie chick was a particularly popular one. The sexually exploited virgin, you know, usually a victim of an older predatory male. And I think that particular stereotype was appealing to so-called straight adults who couldn't quite wrap their minds around why their daughters had run off to join the circus. So they were essentially victims, right? And then there were other stereotypes that women of the counterculture themselves conformed to a certain extent and helped to reinforce. The love goddess was one, or the exotic vamp figure. But the more negative ones that took hold most strongly were, I think, those that had the greatest currency within popular culture in the mainstream middle class.
Yeah. You know, your introduction begins with a portrait of Denise Kaufman, who, it turns out, figures pretty prominently in a biography of Jan Wenner that I just read in manuscript. And tell us more about Denise and Kaufman and why you decided to open the book with her, with a quick sketch of her and her life.
Okay, well, Denise was a young folk musician, later turned a psychedelic rocker. She arrived in the Bay Area when she was in her teens, late teens, and became part of the early counterculture scene. She was Mary Microgram, who got on the bus with Ken Kesey. And then later she put together an all-woman band that by all accounts was really good. Part of the early psychedelic scene, and in many ways their lyrics, the band was called Ace of Cups, their lyrics were truer to the values that the counterculture was espousing during the time than were the male rock counterparts. Yeah. But she and her band were completely eclipsed by the male bands, and I was talking to Matt earlier about this, how the recording industry made a decision to market and gear music toward a male adolescent late teen audience.
Interesting.
So despite the talent.
Yeah. Yeah. You note that other hippie women developed these countercultural identities pretty early on. And many of the women were white and middle class, and their ideas about sex were, as you say, essentialist and heteronormative. Even so, they're pushing against the mainstream culture and toward different forms of sexual liberation. How would you describe their challenges and accomplishments in that department?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think young women were not so much reacting against discrete gender roles as they were the specific gender roles of their mothers. They were reacting against the suburban domesticity that they saw their mothers trapped within. And when they joined the counterculture, they found themselves performing domestic tasks a lot of the time. But the performance of those tasks was in a novel environment, often in a communal setting, or in terms of the Back to the Land movement, an extremely challenging setting. So in many ways, they were replicating the roles of their pioneer grandmothers and great-grandmothers. So they didn't feel oppressed or constrained by those roles. What they did encounter, though, was a lot of laziness on the part of their male counterparts, where it looked like they were performing a disproportionate share of the labor needed to sustain their families and communities, and the men were sitting around smoking a lot of dope and philosophizing. So their feminist rebellion ultimately grew out of not dissatisfaction with their roles, but with their sense that the men weren't contributing equally to this utopian countercultural experiment.
Okay, well, that leads to my next question, which is, by the mid-1970s, you conclude that hippie women articulated a feminist vision that emphasized the dignity, if not superiority, of female values and labor. What were the values, and what kinds of labor are you thinking of when in that conclusion?
Right. I want to just preface this by noting that Allen Ginsberg referred to the counterculture set of values as representing the affectionate feminine. So it made sense for counterculture women to embrace this notion of difference, that women are inherently different, if not better, than men when they constructed their particular type of feminism. So like you said, their feminism emphasized female difference, and not just difference, but superiority to men. And they kind of parlayed this into influence in post-60s movements for social change, specifically the New Age, mm-hmm. where by virtue of being more intuitive, in touch with their feelings, their body, the earth, being by nature, and this is by nature in quotation marks, by nature more gentle, giving, compassionate, and peaceful, they asserted that they were the true daughters of Aquarius, sort of the true leaders of this new age that was being ushered in. So their contributions ranged from changes in healthcare, looking at human health holistically, an integrative approach, and introducing non-Western healing practices. Also extended into education or educational reform, looking at young people as the whole person, experiential education, individualized learning. They also claimed leadership roles in 70s environmental movements. I'm thinking of the anti-nuclear movement in particular, but also started and launched their own environmental organizations like Farallon's Institute here in the Bay Area and Planet Drum Foundation. And again, as inherently nurturing, life-giving, women carved out leadership role in terms of environmental activism. I'm also thinking about their contributions to sustainability more generally, that it was women of the counterculture that didn't invent organic agriculture, but resurrected it. So sustainable agricultural practices, and introduced Americans more generally, the American mainstream, into a different way of eating, consuming food that was produced more sustainably, locally, more plant-based, so with less of an impact on the planet, and that vegetarian didn't have to be bland. Another thing in terms of food that I found fascinating was that women took off on the hippie trail, right? So they traveled abroad in unprecedented numbers, and they brought back different tastes and preferences, expanded the American palate. So I could go on and on and on about their legacy and contributions. But.
Well, that's probably what you had in mind when you said, this is at the very conclusion, you close by urging your readers to review the book's photographs. Quote, the people who brought us these alternatives, and here you're talking about organic gardens, farmers markets, recycling, etc. Those people were kids. It's not General Electric, Exxon, Toyota, or Safeway that invented green alternatives. It was these heartbreakingly young daughters and sons of Aquarius. And so if we're looking at the 60s and its long tail, which is our topic for today, where do these green alternatives fit into the picture now? I'm mindful of the fact that I'm asking you this just a few days after the President of the United States decided to withdraw the country from the Paris Accords. What's your sense? And I mean, you wrote this book a few years ago, and what does your instinct tell you now about how we're doing on the green alternative scene?
Well, to a large extent, green alternatives have been co-opted and commercialized, but also remain at the grassroots level. And I'm thinking, as I walked over here today, of the Berkeley Farmers Market.
Mm-hmm.
That's concrete evidence that small, decentralized, community-supported, sustainable alternatives
right.
are still functioning, and in many cases are preferred by yeah. consumers.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, great, Gretchen. Matt, I want to turn to you. Your the periodization here is 1965 to 1975, but in your introduction, you describe your family's radical past and note that there were really two major formative influences in your life, and that was music and political revolution. And so keeping the focus on you for a moment, how did those two influences play out in your life? I mean, what did they make possible or impossible or imaginable or unimaginable, say, compared to growing up somewhere else or at some other time?
Well, in terms of direct personal experience, my youth was spent in the dancing school, which was inspired by Isadora Duncan. So her influence was on my grandmother, who started the first modern dance school in San Francisco in 1912, and then my mother and myself. So there was a definite lineage there as far as a, you know, radical artistic movement in and of itself. But then that was connected to my father, who was a longshoreman and was involved in the 34 general strike. And I mean, was directly involved in it at the time, and then later on remained, you know, politically active. In fact, as I say in the introduction, I was awakened at 4 a.m. by him to drag me over to the free speech movement to see history being made. I was 13, I guess.
And your sister, you mentioned, was also involved with the famous incident at City Hall in San Francisco.
Right. She was washed down the steps with the rest of her class.
Washed down the steps with the fire hoses. And they were, of course, protesting the
House Un-American Activities Committee. And
right.
obviously the significance of that, it was marked the end of the 50s and right. the defeat of McCarthyism in the one place that had resisted it.
Yeah. So one of your first question is, why San Francisco?
Well, in the answer to that, I mean, first of all, I asked the question because I really wanted to know, and not just from my personal experience, but from the vantage point of studying history. And
by this you mean, why did San Francisco become a kind of political and musical epicenter?
Right. You could put it as, why did Santana and the Black Panthers emerge in the same place at the same time? And the basic orientation for that did arise from these earlier references, Isadora Duncan, Tom Mooney, who was world famous by 1918. He'd been arrested after the Preparedness Day bombing in San Francisco in 1916, and Free Tom Mooney became a rallying cry for workers all over the world. So there was a basis for San Francisco's international reputation from these two sources, the labor movement on the one side and modern dance on the other. And that relationship basically continued pretty much unabated. It never really stopped. And you had particular characteristics of San Francisco that distinguished it from New York and Los Angeles, which are obviously the centers of American, you know, power, both political and cultural, or you know, the centers of the music industry or the art industry, whatever. And part of it is the distance between San Francisco and those centers. But part of it is the activities, local activities, of organizations like the Longshore Union, which was not only the labor movement, but it was an anti-racist organization that brought into its ranks black and white workers, not only into their ranks, but into the leadership. They made Paul Robeson an honorary member, and so on. This is unusual for American unions at the time, and ever since, for that matter. And so the relationship between them and the modern dance movement is also very close. Not only were people married to each other, in the case of my family, but there was an interpenetration that went on because many of the activities that were engaged in by the labor, a more sophisticated, better educated labor force in support of radical art from in terms of the modern dance, and they were linked together in support of the labor movement and so on. Of course, this led to things like Diego Rivera being invited, the mural movement coming to San Francisco and painting Coit Tower, and other examples of that type, and later on people like Ferlinghetti and Kenneth Rexroth coming to San Francisco because of this reputation, leading directly into the Beats and so on and so forth. But what's forgotten is this is a continuous movement that's taking place on a local basis. Sure, it gained notoriety internationally, and it did have a very substantive impact in different ways internationally, but it really had, this is, you might say, part of the answer to the question of why San Francisco is because of the hype and hoopla that's resulted since. If you understand what I mean, that it appears that something happened in 1967 that suddenly made everybody want to come there, or that, you know, hundreds of thousands of white middle-class brats showed up in a town that nobody lived in and to have a party in Golden Gate Park, you know, which of course corresponds directly to Ronald Reagan's portrayal, and that has become inscribed in history, and therefore has to be combated with this background.
Yeah. I mean, the description you just offered reminded me a little bit of Ralph J. Gleason's, who, of course, lived over here on Ashby, and he co-founded the Monterey Pop Festival and Rolling Stone magazine. And I think when asked the same question, why San Francisco or why the Bay Area, he said the three Bs, Bridges, Harry Bridges, Beats, and Berkeley. Mm. So I know the focus is on San Francisco, but as a, you know, we're in Berkeley, so... Where does Berkeley figure in your story? Or let me put it this way. Where does Ralph Gleason figure in this story? I know you mention him at several points and say that he sometimes was on the wrong side of these showdowns with more radical political elements. But how do you regard Ralph Gleason in the story that you're telling?
Oh, well, Gleason is particularly important because he actually plays a almost unique. He's not the only one, but he's one of a very small handful of people who were read by everyone in the Bay Area.
To mention he also wrote for the Chronicle, of course, San Francisco Chronicle, and Ramparts magazine.
Right, and he was the first full-time jazz critic in the United States on a daily newspaper. Started in 1950, but in any case, he was read by virtually everyone, musicians and workers, whatever. Everybody read Ralph Gleason, and he had that kind of broad influence, but more importantly, he had a direct involvement with what he was writing about, and that goes back to his support for the civil rights movement, for Lenny Bruce in particular. He championed, the battles against the censorship. I mean, people might have forgotten that in 1957, Howell was brought up in an obscenity trial. Later after that, Tropic of Cancer, 1961, Henry Miller, and so on and so forth. There were many cases of that type in the late 50s, early 60s, and he was a champion of civil rights and, you know, the rights of artists to speak and so on. But by the time the 60s began in earnest, or the my period, 1965, he was an early advocate and documenter of these events. Mm-hmm. And so my interest in Ralph was not so much what he'd done before, but the fact that his chronicling of those events has to be compared with what's been written since. Since he was there as a participant and an observer and a respected journalist, then you have to say, well, what does he say in comparison to what was written 40 years later? Right. And this, the difference is stark. It's quite striking, because his earliest descriptions of the the original dance concerts launched by the Family Dog, and later the mime troupe appeals that were organized by the mime troupe and Bill Graham, their business manager. He describes these as festivals. And he uses the term in the old religious sense of the word, not jazz festival or folk festival, but in Mardi Gras or Carnival or the Vendange or the religious or seasonal rites where the public, the working people, gather together to celebrate themselves. And this is a very crucial observation on his part. You know, he's not polemicizing. He's perhaps a booster. He was definitely a booster of the San Francisco sound and all that, but he's really talking about it as it appeared. But that's not how it's written about subsequently, not at all. In fact, what's celebrated are stadium rock and A Day on the Green, which took its place, which basically usurped the festival and turned it into a not just a money-making thing, but it transformed this kind of festival in which the audience is the show, the audience is why it's happening, into simply consumers of a product.
Yeah, I guess two people that don't come off very well in your account. One is Bill Graham, who was behind The Day on the Green, and the other is Jan Wenner. And talk a little bit about their activities and what it did or didn't do to advance the goals that you endorse.
Yeah, well, first of all, in the case of Bill Graham, it's slightly complicated because of the connections he had at the very beginning to the San Francisco Mime Troupe and his role in that, and in the early days of the movement or the development of the kind of programming that brought music as such to this welcoming audience, that in fact is the reason that it succeeded, because it was the audience that demanded this, that wanted this variety and this relationship between musics of all different kinds, which were encouraged to flourish. I mean, Graham himself had no clue about music. Mm-hmm. He didn't know anything about it, and he was relying entirely on the suggestions made by other musicians. And frankly, if he were here, he wouldn't deny that. But through the course of all of this, the role that he played, and again, this is not just my personal view, this is a question of 100 hours of interviews with people who worked with him or were related to him, as well as dozens of documentary accounts of what transpired in his business dealings. Essentially, he developed a model that was crucial in co-opting musicians, individual musicians, as well as music, you might say, as a whole, popular culture. And that was that he was not actually a participant at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, but he was an observer. And he watched Albert Grossman, who managed Bob Dylan, operate. And he realized in an instant that the way the music industry was treating musicians, which was essentially telling them what to say, telling them what to wear, telling them what to play, essentially guiding them, ruling them, if you want to say, was going to kill the goose that was laying the golden egg. Mm-hmm. And that the real way forward was to declare himself the defender of the musicians against the music industry. Mm-hmm. And that these were visionary artists. They were the messiahs who were coming with the truth, right?
Yeah.
So his hero was Saul Hirock. And for him, people like the managers of bands and people in the music industry were on a lower peak, if you want to say. They just were interested in entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
He was interested in art, and I'm going to deliver the artist to the audience. And so he cultivated this relationship with bands and musicians and whatnot, and he was quite effective in doing that. But the model that he developed then advanced as he saw his success increase, and this included what ultimately became stadium or corporate rock. And by the time Journey was around, it was literally declared as corporate rock. Herbie Herbert, who worked for Bill Graham and was the manager of Journey, literally went and made deals with Budweiser and others to essentially sell the soul of this, what had been previously a rebellious thing. And so my critique of Graham is a political as well as an artistic critique. Mm-hmm. The political aspect is that he served the counter-revolution. Mm. And I don't think that really can be denied, because the role that he played, regardless of his intentions or best wishes, was to divert and lead the what was wild and free back into the grip of the music industry.
Mm-hmm.
And to perfect methods of cultivating that. Where that ties in with Jan Wenner is that Wenner's purpose actually was from the beginning was pretty well stated. In fact, the Rolling Stone itself made very clear that what they were interested in was the rock revolution. And there was no rock revolution. I mean, in other words, this was a combination of a musical form with a political term to essentially defang both and institutionalize both. And so you have a process. It didn't happen all at once. You have a process, but the inevitable conclusion was to divert rock and rock musicians into the Democratic Party. Hmm. This is where they're going to go, because by 1976, right after my period ends, you see rock bands being used by Jimmy Carter's campaign. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, it's systematic. There's no doubt that was the plan all along. Hmm. And what's really tragic about it in terms of music, coming back to that, leaving aside the political issues involved, is that what was happening before that was truly a musical renaissance, and a big part of that is that a whole generation of young people learned to love music as such. Mm-hmm. It wasn't rock. It was all music. And so you'd have, and this is evidence, the posters that we printed in the book are just one small sampling, where you'd have Ross on Roland Kirk playing with the Grateful Dead, or you'd have Sun Ra playing with Country Joe and the Fish, or Bolasetti, or whatever. This was common, typical. It represented what was the sound of music. And of course, that was amplified by freeform radio, where for several years you had this broadcasting of albums. There, the breakdown of the industry norms that established the 3-minute limit, black and white radio stations, black and white charts, black and white music, black and white nice clubs, the absolute segregation of society into these two unequal parts. We could talk even more about women. That's a whole separate issue. Yeah. And there's a chapter in the book about that too, but this is just speaking broadly about what was popular and what was breaking down
right.
by way of the 60s.
So there's a lot there. I want to give David a chance here, but I have a bunch of comebacks here that I want to get to you. And of course, there'll be time for everyone's questions and the panel's questions for each other as well. David, your book, Season of the Witch, which, of course, the title echoes the title of the Donovan song in 1966. There's been so much attention paid to San Francisco counterculture in the 1960s, maybe the early 70s. What drew you to the topic of San Francisco in the 1970s and the 1980s?
Well, I mean, I think in an immediate sense, what it was my sons, who I was raising in San Francisco, we would drive around the city and I'd point out these historic places musically, politically, and start telling them these stories, and they'd want to hear more. And it just seemed to me, because the New York publishing industry is so parochial, so provincial, that, you know, if New York had been San Francisco or vice versa, there would have been 20 books like mine being published by the New York industry. So here was this phenomenal story, I felt, this revolution, political and cultural revolution, that happened right here in the Bay Area in this phenomenally compressed time and this compressed geography, really, given how small an area we really are. And it not only transformed the city, but the world. And so I thought it was important to memorialize that, and to, while enough of the people were still alive, like the other panelists here, to go around and interview people, talk to them, and conjure up that amazing, dangerous, and revolutionary era for a general readership. I think the main contribution my book made was to take away some of the hippie flower children sort of imagery and, which is very commercialized, as Matt was saying, in a way, of that era, and to show, as I write in the introduction, that San Francisco values, so-called, did not come into this world with flowers in their hair, but howling and blood and strife. This was about struggle. This was about people squatting, taking over derelict houses, fighting with cops, getting beaten up, getting killed, bad drug deals, bad drugs coming into neighborhoods, and people organizing to push out those drug dealers. It was taking on City Hall and fighting City Hall and running people for office. It was linking up with the Black Panthers, white radicals, white musicians, I just did an interview for another project with Bobby Seale, and he talked to me at great length about his friendship with John Lennon. So there were these remarkable kind of, bridges being built, these epiphanies, these great leaps forward in human consciousness and imagination. And I get so angry, and I'm sure all of you do, about the counter assault on that period that still we get, these books that keep getting churned out by New York, and they're of this new consciousness, which is, to demean, to trivialize, to belittle the cultural and political revolutions of the 60s and 70s. That we were narcissistic, that baby boomers are selfish, that we were not patriotic, all the same bullshit. And the truth is, we were too radical for the powers that be. They fought us tooth and nail. They assassinated our leaders. They beat us up. They flooded neighborhoods with bad drugs that they cooked up in their military labs. They did everything possible to us to fuck it up. And yet we somehow managed to, I think, win the Cultural Revolution. We came this close to winning the political one. And I think if Bernie Sanders had won in the last election instead of another baby boomer, Donald Trump, we would have come close even to winning the political one. So I say to those who get the past wrong, who fuck it up for political reasons or just out of ignorance, no. The only thing that I regret about those days, as Robert Stone, the great writer, wrote in his memoir before he died, is that we didn't win. That's my only regret, politically.
You know, going back to the beginning of the period that you write about, David, many observers thought that the that Altamont and the Manson family murders, which of course were almost coincided in December of 1969, that brought the curtain down on the 60s. I think Ralph Gleason's position. Stuart Brand disagreed. He said, all that stuff comes with the territory. It's the flip side of the same kind of Dionysian coin. But it wasn't just Altamont, it was also Zebra Murders, the Patty Hearst saga, Jonestown, and so on. How do you connect the utopianism of San Francisco counterculture and the political violence that you chart in the 1970s?
Well, partly, as I said earlier, it was a conscious policy on the city's part under Mayor Alioto and other administrations to withdraw from certain areas, to let them go derelict, and so they could then bulldoze them and redevelop them, like happened with the Fillmore. That was a conscious urban policy that was overseen by Justin Herman, this despicable man, the Robert Moses of San Francisco, who we continue to honor by putting his name on the plaza in the Embarcadero. I mean, I wrote a column about this for the Chronicle. We should organize a movement, I think, to strip that name off that plaza, because his name is synonymous with racist urban development or Negro removal, as James Baldwin called it. So some of this was conscious policy to let these neighborhoods become darker, more dangerous, drug infested, and so on, so they could be redeveloped. But to the and there was crime, and there was rape, and there were bad drugs and drug overdoses, and as I said. But to the great honor of many of the people who lived there, like one of my favorite chapters was on the Good Earth family commune and the hate that I wrote about. I hadn't known about that commune until I started to research Season the Witch, and Calvin Welch, a longtime activist in the hate, turned me on to them. But these were these guys, originally the guys were founders, but it was women and men. And the leaders of the group were Vietnam veterans. They were ex-cons. They were tough dudes. They weren't no flower children, as Peter Coyote likes to say. And the neighborhood was getting infested with heroin at that point by 68. And so these guys had guns, and they stood their ground, and they forced out the heroin dealers. And then they took over these houses that were falling apart, these beautiful old Victorians that are now worth $3-4 million, and they renovated them because they also had carpentry skills. They could do stuff. And everyone was expected in those communes to do something. They weren't lazy hippies. They ran shops. They ran garages. They ran painting crews. They ran clothing stores. And my experience, by the way, Gretchen, is interesting. I agree with you that, you know, there was rampant sexism, particularly in those years, the 60s and the counterculture and in communes. But that there was a backlash, I think, pretty early. And by the time I got to Santa Cruz, for instance, as a student in 1969, the commune that I was part of was a socialist, feminist, lesbian commune. And you know, it was the women, believe me, who ran that house. And the men had to follow that leadership, or they were not going to be welcome there much longer. So I think a lot of the lessons were being learned early, some of the problems we had. But certainly in terms of the darkness, Peter, I do think it was in part because of urban policy and what we were fighting against, these neighborhoods that were becoming more dangerous and slummy and that we had to reclaim. And also I write in the book how it was the poison of the war that started to seep back into the country's bloodstream. You know, Robert Stone, I think if you haven't read Dog Soldiers and you want to know what the Vietnam War did to America, that's the one great novel that has been written about that, Dog Soldiers, because it showed that the wounded, psychically wounded men who came back from the war, and just the whole poison of watching every day this huge, gargantuan, technologically advanced, militarized country stomp on this peasant population in Vietnam was soul-killing. And that's what happened. And a lot of us, including me, were draft age. And we were looking at our future, not just getting high and having fun and going to the Fillmore or going to Golden Gate Park. We were wondering, am I going to be in uniform being shot at or in killing people next month or next summer? Or am I going to be in jail? Or am I going to be underground? So I remember Peter Lewis from Moby Grape, which was this great band in the 60s, I think great unsung band, San Francisco band, and got, unfortunately, fucked up by some of the commercialization, Columbia Records, that Matt talks about. But in any case, Peter told me at one point, he looked out at the crowd, this usually ecstatic crowd one night at the Fillmore, and he became chilled looking at the faces staring up at him. All these young people looking, you know, as if they were wanted to be saved. They needed to be saved. And that's how powerful rock and roll was at that time, that actually we thought we could be saved by these visionary musicians and the power of the music. And we needed to be saved because, frankly, America was in great pain and despair, not only because of the war, but because of the racial conflicts and poverty at home. America was deeply fucked up, and it started, in my feeling, when, you know, we started to kill the leaders who could have saved this country. And that's another thing that American journalism and historians still won't deal with out of cowardice and ignorance, is the assassinations that changed the course of human events in this country in the 1960s. They kill a John F. Kennedy, they kill a Malcolm X, they kill a Bobby Kennedy, they kill a Martin Luther King. Don't you think that changes history?
You don't have a ton of time left, but I want to ask, I've got to ask you about journalism, Bay Area journalism, because I know from your experience at Ramparts, your current experience at Salon, and your current experience at the San Francisco Chronicle. I know from our conversations that you were influenced by Ramparts, that you were a big fan. And I want to ask you about that influence. I want to give a quick shout out to Julie Thompson, who's here and is producing a documentary film about Robert Scheer, who's also here at the book festivals. I believe Julie has some information that you can get on how to help that documentary happen. But David, how do you think that magazine, which peaked during the Summer of Love, but wasn't especially well-disposed to hippies, how did that magazine influence you and your contemporaries, either at Salon or elsewhere?
Well, it wasn't a hippie magazine, because Warren Hinkle was a Catholic boy from San Francisco who didn't really get the Cultural Revolution in many ways. But, you know, artistically, it was really with the spirit. Dugald Stürmer, as you know, Peter, was a brilliant designer. And the art in that magazine, I think, really did reflect the period. But, yeah, Ramparts, to me, I'm here because Ramparts, in large part. I was in military school in the 60s in Los Angeles, and I would have to read Ramparts hidden behind a textbook in my study halls, or else I would have been busted. It was a dangerous magazine to read in much of America. And it had a huge impact, not just on me, but on Martin Luther King, for instance. I know Peter knows the story. And Peter's book, by the way, if you want to know more about ramparts, is the book to read. And, you know, Martin Luther King saw the photo spread that Warren Hinkle and Robert Scheer bravely decided to publish in Ramparts in 1967, I believe it was, of the horrendous photos of napalmed and wounded and horribly disfigured Vietnamese children who had suffered because of American bombing. And Martin Luther King, who was eating lunch at the time, I believe, put down the magazine and said, "That's it." And shortly thereafter, he delivered his landmark speech at Riverside Church in New York City, condemning not just the war, but American militarism, and with the searing language saying any society that spends more money on killing people than on educating its children is in mortal danger of losing its soul. And I'm afraid that's where America went. But in any case, a year to that day later, Martin Luther King is killed. So Ramparts magazine was a flaming vehicle of truth for people like me. It was saying things that none of the rest of the American media had the courage to say. And it was saying it with humor sometimes, with satire, with great sense of San Francisco-like fun and rebelliousness. And, you know, from Che Guevara's diary to the photo spread I talked about to some of the great investigative reporting on the CIA and its infiltration of the student movement, these, if you really want to understand the 60s and what was happening there, you have to start with Ramparts.
Yeah. And of course, its alumni went on to found Rolling Stone and Mother Jones, which are still around today. But the other thing that Ramparts did is they ran these big blockbuster stories on the deep state. And I know that's a persistent concern of yours, and it comes up in your most recent book. Tell us about your work on that and how it might be connected to the long 60s.
Well, again, I think, when I say they altered history through their politics of violence, that shows you what I mean. I believe that those assassinations were organized by elements of the state. My latest book is The Devil's Chessboard, and it's about Alan Dulles, who was the legendary head of the CIA through much of this period in the Cold War. And it was Alan Dulles who became involved in a very bitter power conflict, like we see today with Trump and the deep state, with John F. Kennedy. Over Kennedy's desire, and I'm very convinced of this, having interviewed everyone from Robert McNamara on down within the Kennedy administration, was determined not just to withdraw from Vietnam, but to establish detente with Moscow and with Havana. He was, speaking of back channels, like we are hearing a lot about today, the Kennedy brothers opened up a number of back channels to Moscow, to Havana, to the Pope, in a desperate effort to extract the world from this nuclear precipice that Kennedy was deathly afraid we would fall over. Mm. And so I thought it was essential for people to understand this history, because the assassination of Kennedy, I think, is the beginning of this terrible trajectory that we're launched on now as a country, where the national security state basically intervened to overthrow an American president. And with terrible, tragic consequences. The CIA had been allowed to do this, encouraged to do this, for years overseas in the Congo, in Central America, in Iran. And finally, Alan Dulles and his hubris brought that assassination operation home to this country. Now, after 50-some years after the President Kennedy's assassination, if American historians and journalists and the media can't go there, I mean, what good are they, frankly? I interviewed Ben Bradley, who was JFK's best friend in the Washington Press Corps. I interviewed Don Hewitt, the creator of 60 Minutes. Those were two of the institutions you would have thought that would have solved the Kennedy assassination. They even had the cover of a congressional investigation in the 1970s, because, you know, the media loves to go behind government, and then they feel a little bolder when government starts to investigate something. So they had actually a fairly good investigation underway in the mid-1970s during that period when there was a brief opening after Watergate, when Washington wanted to sort of uncover some of these things. And it was the House Select Committee on Assassinations was doing some good work looking into the Kennedy assassination. And you know what the New York Times and the Washington Washington Post did instead? They started demeaning the investigation. They said, well, they're spending too much money, they're taking too long, where are they going with this thing? Instead of having their own reporters follow behind like they should have been doing. So I asked Ben Bradlee face to face near the end of his life. They still gave him a little office at the Washington Post. He was coming in there, you know, the great Jason Robards we remember from the movie. So I said, Ben, you know, you wrote this whole book, Conversations with Kennedy, about how tight you were, what good buddies you were, how Kennedy would have you over the White House. Weren't you curious? You knew, you know, you had suspicions that things, you know, the Warren Commission wasn't the real story. He goes, yeah, no, I know, I did. Well, why didn't you look into it? Well, you know, I'd just taken over at the Washington Post in those years. I think he was fiddling with the history a little bit, the dates. But he said, and I knew that if I launched a serious investigation, the Kennedy assassination, people would say I'm obsessed because they knew I was Jack's friend. They think it was a personal thing. So I never went there.
Okay.
And I go, so anyway, I could go on and on about the media, but
okay. Well, let me bring you back to San Francisco real quickly, yeah. Though. You've been a critic of the so-called sharing economy, and I just, you know, we're talking about Lyft and Airbnb and Uber and so on. Just quick style, is that a sort of continuation, adaptation, co-optation of the values of this sharing economy, or what's happening in San Francisco and the Bay Area now with this new innovation? Is this something we should be thinking about in terms of our broader question of what the long 60s is all about?
Well, I was interested in hearing Fred saying that in some ways the seeds of what we're going through now were planted by the psychedelic revolution. I know John Markoff, who's in the audience, has written about that connection too between the psychedelic revolution and the cyber revolution. You know, and Steve Jobs obviously was, you know, sort of a symbol of that. I see that, though, I have a darker view. You know, I'm seen as a sort of anti-techie now, even though I was a techie for a while when I started Salon Online. But I think of the libertarian seed and the Pentagon seed that were always part of the counterculture world as sort of demon seeds that need to be resisted. And it's a selfish gene, and I think the sharing economy is a mask for rank exploitation and anti-labor policies and screwing basically cities like San Francisco. They're running rampant, they're unregulated, they're displacing people, Airbnb, Uber's destroying the taxi industry and crowding the streets to the point where you can't get anywhere in less than an hour in San Francisco now. I mean, so I just think of that, you know, libertarian streak within the counterculture as ultimately a very damaging and destructive one. And certainly when you start to look at some of how the research and development stuff came out of DARPA, the internet came out of the Pentagon, that's an interesting connection too. I'm not down with these sort of like hippie, you know, sort of visionary types who love going to these military conferences and hanging out with guys in uniform.
Okay. All right, it's time for questions, but I just want to remind you that we've got the books here, and there will be a signing immediately after this session. I want to ask the panel first if there are any questions for each other.
I just wanted to respond to something you were saying, how I see this happening with educational reform, how a lot of countercultural ideas have permeated both public and private education. But one of the things that's happening now that I think is so insidious is this appropriation of sort of the libertarian language of choice, that everybody's kid is different, very countercultural, right? You have to individualize education, but is now being appropriated to rationalize the expansion of charter schools and also school vouchers, which ultimately undermine public education.
Yeah. I think we could probably multiply the examples on that. Fred?
So I want to pick up on something that David was saying, and I want to second his discomfort with the libertarian strand that ran through the counterculture and runs into our own time. It's one I'm very uncomfortable with. I argue in my book that it actually emerges through an embrace of cybernetics and World War II research styles. One of the things that surprised me in spending a lot of time in Stuart Brand's papers and the papers of other folks is how much they were reading from the 40s and 50s that was in fact created at the epicenter of American military industrial culture. One thing I do want to be a little bit careful careful about, and I want to issue a qualification that may be a little uncomfortable. I don't think there was one counterculture. I think there were several, and we have to make those distinctions. It was not simply a we. There was a counterculture, a San Francisco-based counterculture, very much oriented toward the transformation of consciousness in lieu of politics. I would argue there was a Berkeley counterculture, very devoted to doing politics, to change politics, supported the new left. We've got to make those distinctions. My beef today is not with the new left. My beef is with the turn toward commerce, consciousness, and technology in lieu of politics. And I think it's that turn that sets the stage for Uber and Lyft in a way that I'm not comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well put. Okay, thank you for your patience. Questions? And we have microphones, I believe, that we need to mobilize. First this here, okay. Right here, sorry.
Can they raise their hand? Okay, great. Can we get through here? Is that okay? Thank you. Oh, okay. If it's all right, I have two questions.
Is it a two-part question?
No, they're two separate.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. So my first question is actually for Ms. Lemke Santangelo. So you mentioned that a lot of the women who joined the hippie movement were trying to resist the suburban lifestyle that their mothers were trapped in, but they found that they were playing similar roles just in a different environment. So, you know, over 50 years later, things have improved, but from my experience, I feel like that is still an issue to a certain extent in different industries where women are not, the industry is not seen as fitting for, you know, the stereotype of feminine traits. So do you have any guidance or insights for young people like me who are forming our careers of how can we kind of break that and not only be able to work in new environments, but different roles in those environments as well?
So that okay, let's take that question first.
Okay. I actually have a beef with the counterculture in this regard. And it's not that all countercultural women embraced a feminism that, in essence, reified or reinforced difference, but many of them did. And I think ultimately the way out of the constraints that women still face is not to reinforce the notion of difference, but to continually deconstruct and challenge it. I don't think that counterculture women, at least not many of them, were helpful in that project, that regard.
Okay, very good. You have one more?
Yeah. The reason that I came to the panel was I was really hoping to get some key takeaways from your experience and the 60s trends and see what I could apply to today. You all gave me a lot of good food for thought of like what were some implicit takeaways, but I'd love to hear if any of the panelists have explicit lessons learned that you think are very relevant to what's going on in today's American culture and political context.
That's a big one.
I'll take a quick shot at that. Okay. I have a strong feeling about this. They used to say in the 60s, don't trust anyone over 30. I think for folks in your age, it's don't trust networks. Trust institutions. One of the legacies of the counterculture is a radical critique of institutions as a whole. I think that's a mistake. Institutions are the only things that are keeping us out of Donald Trump's hands right now. Mm.
But I also think somewhat contradictory to that is build our own institutions.
Very good. Fine.
Because that's another lesson of the 60s. We built the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, which is still here. We built Huckleberry House because it was against the law at the time to run away as a teenager, and that was an important shelter. So, you know, and I have to say, standing up for Bill Graham a little bit, a lot of those institutions were built through the concerts that he organized, the rock concerts. Bill Graham, I think, is a complicated guy, and I think ultimately Matt's right that he did sell out sort of the revolution, but he played an important role in the 60s in helping to fund those things. And frankly, as I learned from starting Salon, my own institution, which in some ways was a bridge between these different eras here in San Francisco, you need financing and you need to be creative about how you're going to get it. I think one of the great breakthroughs of the Bernie Sanders campaign was to show that we could do it with $27 each instead of relying on billionaires. So we have to be really creative about building our own institutions that sustain us and create the world that we want to live in. And we have to be creative about how to finance those institutions and keep them going.
Good one, Dan.
Just a quick addition, not really different, but in my view, the errors of the new left or the shortcomings of the new left, not necessarily the counterculture, and there is a difference in that sense, but was essentially the future that was envisioned was a future of what would not be. And what we need is a vision of the future that will be. Mm. What is going to replace capitalism? If your entire imagination is wrapped up in ending war, ending oppression, ending poverty, and so on, that's up to a point that's good, but unless you can envision what will replace it, and you have a problem, and this is exactly where the split between music or art in general and politics came in, because it was left to the artists to envision a new society, and that's fine, artists always do that, or many artists will do it, but it's necessary for there to be a political component that actually articulates what the future will be, so that it infuses the struggles today with a vision of tomorrow.
And Matt, there was a fusion between that political and artistic vision in some of the 60s uprisings, like Paris in May 68 with the Situationists and others who were sort of had a foot in both worlds, the art world and the political world. And of course, the great slogan that came out of Paris in 1968 was "All power to the imagination."
Very good. Sorry, Gretchen.
No, I just wanted to add something quickly. I think that we've gone through a 30-year period where collective action of all kinds has been discredited, by the mainstream media and political leadership. And in my mind, collective action is the only type of action that yields results. So join with friends, with family, and work locally, but work as a collective.
Good. Thank you, Gretchen. Yes, please.
We have four very contrasting ideologies here. In some ways, kind of mutually contradictory. In some ways, they converge. I see, overarchingly, the counterculture as I see a direct line from Walt Whitman to American Beauty as a kind of valedictory. Each of the four ideologies, I'm very wary of the claim that the organized left has tried to keep as like a proprietary claim on a cultural phenomenon. I'm very wary of prescriptive, ideologically based futures. Second.
Okay, may I ask you to put it in the form of a question, because we're a little short on time.
Each of these is like a question at each. I'd like Matt to speak to that. I would like to point out that Barlow was always a Republican operative on the libertarian right. How about Janis Joplin and Grace Slick when you talk about the ascendancy of male bands? And finally, Talbot, you're brilliant, but how the hell can you make Di-Fi the hero of the San Francisco Spirit?
How do you what?
How can you make Di-Fi the exemplar of the San Francisco Spirit? That's where I found myself.
Dianne Feinstein.
Oh, Di-Fi. Ah, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Season of the Witch.
Yeah, I did call it the Margaret Dumont, though, of San Francisco.
Did anybody else have any response to that? Okay, points well taken, but let's see. Yes, please. Just wait for the mic then. Thank you.
This one is for you, David. You mentioned Michael Stepanian, and I was fortunate enough to grow up with him as a member of the rugby team. And I find it interesting that sports has never really been included in the counterculture subject matter. In the 60s, they fought racism from an athletic point of view. And they were also used as a undercover mission for the CIA. I don't know if Michael's ever told you that stories. We'll talk. But I think it's interesting in that, you know, we kind of leave that part out sometimes. It's about the aspect of a sports representation in a very interesting, you know, counterculture moment.
Mm-hmm. Good
sports are important, and of course I end Season of the Witch with the 49ers first Super Bowl season, which actually, in terms of a festival, was a people's festival in many ways that brought together different classes, different races. You know, people from Mona's bar, lesbian bars, were pouring into the streets with the particularly the victory over Dallas, which was seen in cultural and political terms as the antithesis, obviously, of San Francisco. It's where they killed Kennedy, for God's sake. Anyway, but I, so yes, yeah, sports, I think, you know, can play a role. I think, look at LeBron James and others who do speak out today. I think that carries enormous weight on Black Lives Matter. Colin Kaepernick is a hero, you know. So one quick question about sort of the gender stuff in the counterculture again. Yeah, Janice. Right on, who inspired the Coquettes in part, and talk about gender-bending sex revolutionaries. They were, you know, what do they call themselves? Women with dicks? I mean, so they had men and women in that troupe. They were blowing up all sorts of preconceptions about sexuality and gender, and that was a great San Francisco institution.
I'm afraid we're almost out of time, but I would love it if you could give us a quick question. Here.
Paul, first of all, I want to thank your nuanced reference to there being many countercultures, because I clearly remember that there were people that were very political and that people that were very spiritual, yep. And hardly ever did the twain meet.
That's true.
Ultimately, I was in the middle of that because I got arrested in 1976 for practicing medicine without a license. Mm. I practiced homeopathic medicine. Mm. I was turned in, strangely enough, by a libertarian, which makes no sense. But today, right now, I think Big Pharma has very brilliantly controlled the media message by advertising primarily on news. And as such, it trivializes any alternatives that happen, and of course it makes anyone that questions vaccine safety as a heretic and a lunatic, which is not true at all. And I just wanted to, was there any control of the media in the same way that there is today by any corporation or what?
Well, I think the corporatization of drugs and talking about how important drugs and drug experimentation were to the counterculture and how it did get co-opted in a way by Big Pharma moving in and sort of now look at all of us. We're on our meds, you know, instead of like experimenting on our own. So, yeah, I think that's a great untold story. Some of the darkness of that experimentation, but also the incredible enlightenment that brought. You know, we've seen this written about in various places, but I think the big book still needs to be written about that.
So I wanted to jump in on this and say the distinction that I would actually want to raise is one that came up with the earlier question on race and racism. Drugs in America are handled incredibly differently depending on the race that you have. And that was true in the 60s and it's true now. What we did to raise consciousness and transform ourselves as white people was something that would have had a very different meaning if you were an African American. One of the things that I find strangest about the counterculture, both sides, but particularly the new communalist wing of it, is its unwillingness to reach across racial barriers. You know, the communes that I looked at were almost exclusively white. You know, no one would have said you can't come here because you're black, but they would have said, you know, man, that style you have is it's just kind of uncool. There's a lot of not so subtle racism in the communes. You know, the new left was a little better about it, but I still think that's a challenge for the generation that we are. The challenge is to embrace not only the variety of selves that we are and embody in our whiteness, but the variety of selves that are in our society that are different than we are.
Okay, very good. I'm afraid we're out of time, but please join me in thanking our panelists for their work and participation.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.